pulsing heart growing louder and louder, a heart as strong as my own. Then, in the jagged gap through which we'd come, I saw him. His great, huge shoulder emerged first, and one long, loose arm and hand, the fingers curved. Then I saw his head. Over his other shoulder he was carrying a body. In the broken doorway he straightened and shifted the weight and stared directly into the darkness towards us. Every muscle in me became iron as I looked at him, saw the outline of his head looming there against the sky, but nothing of his face was visible except the barest glint of the moon on his eye as if it were a fragment of glass. Then I saw it glint on his buttons, and heard them rustle as his arms swung free again and one long leg bent as he moved forward and proceeded into the tower right towards us. I held fast to Claudia, ready in an instant to shove her behind me, to step forward to meet him, but then I saw, with astonishment, that his eyes did not see me as I saw him, and he was trudging under the weight of the body he carried towards the monastery door. The moon fell now on his bowed head, on a mass of wavy black hair that touched his bent shoulder, and on the full black sleeve of his coat. I saw something about his coat. The flap of it was badly torn, and the sleeve appeared to be ripped from the seam. I almost fancied I could see his flesh through the shoulder. The human in his arms stirred now and moaned miserably, and the figure stopped for a moment and appeared to stroke the human with his hand. And at that moment I stepped forward from the wall and went towards him. No words passed my lips. I knew none to say. I only knew that I moved into the light of the moon before him, and that his dark, wavy head rose with a jerk, and that I saw his eyes. For one full instant he looked at me, and I saw the light shining in those eyes and then glinting on two sharp canine teeth, and then a low, strangled cry seemed to rise from the depths of his throat, which for a second I thought to be my own. The human crashed to the stones, a shuddering moan escaping his lips, and the vampire lunged at me, that strangled cry rising again as the stench of fetid breath rose in my nostrils, and the claw-like fingers cut into the very fur of my cape. I fell backwards, my head cracking against the wall, my hands grabbing at his head, clutching a mass of tangled filth that was his hair. At once the wet, rotting fabric of his coat ripped in my grasp, but the arm that held me was like iron, and as I struggled to pull the head backwards, the fangs touched the flesh of my throat. Claudia screamed behind him. Something hit his head hard, which stopped him suddenly, and then he was hit again. He turned as if to strike her a blow, and I sent my fist against his face as powerfully as I could. Again a stone struck him as she darted away, and I threw my full weight against him and felt his crippled leg buckling. I remember pounding his head over and over, my fingers all but pulling that filthy hair out by the roots, his fangs projected towards me, his hands scratching, clawing at me. We rolled over and over, until I pinned him down again and the moon shone full on his face. And I realized, through my frantic sobbing breaths, what it was I held in my arms. The two huge eyes bulged from naked sockets, and two small hideous holes made up his nose. Only a putrid, leathery flesh enclosed his skull, and the rank, rotting rags that covered his frame were thick with earth and slime and blood. I was battling a mindless, animated corpse, but no more. From above him, a sharp stone fell full on his forehead, and a fount of blood gushed from between his eyes. He struggled, but another stone crashed with such force I heard the bones shatter. Blood seeped out beneath the matted hair, soaking into the stones and grass. The chest throbbed beneath me, but the arms shuddered and grew still. I drew up, my throat knotted, my heart burning, every fibre of my body aching from the struggle. For a moment the great tower seemed to tilt, but then it righted itself. I lay against the wall, staring at the thing, the blood rushing in my ears. Gradually I realized that Claudia knelt on his chest, that she was probing the mass of hair and bone that had been his head. She was scattering the fragments of his skull. We had met the European vampire, the creature of the old world. He was dead. For a long time I lay on the broad stairway, oblivious to the thick earth that covered it, my head feeling very cool against the earth, just looking at him. Claudia stood at his feet, hands hanging limply at her sides. I saw her eyes close for an instant, two tiny lids that made her face like a small moonlit white statue as she stood there. And then her body began to rock, very slowly. "Claudia," I called to her. She awakened. She was gaunt, such as I had seldom seen her. She pointed to the human who lay far across the floor of the tower near the wall. He was still motionless, but I knew that he was not dead. I'd forgotten him completely, my body aching as it was, my senses still clouded with the stench of the bleeding corpse. But now I saw the man. And in some part of my mind I knew what his fate would be, and I cared nothing for it. I knew it was only an hour at most before dawn. "He's moving," she said to me. And I tried to rise off the steps. Better that he not wake. Better that he never wake at all, I wanted to say. She was walking towards him, passing indifferently the dead thing that had nearly killed us both. I saw her back and the man stirring in front of her, his foot twisting in the grass. I don't know what I expected to see as I drew nearer. What terrified peasant or farmer? What miserable wretch that had already seen the face of that thing that had brought it here? And for a moment I did not realize who it was that lay there. That it was Morgan, whose pale face showed now in the moon, the marks of the vampire on his throat, his blue eyes staring mute and expressionless before him. Suddenly they widened as I drew close to him. "Louis," he whispered in astonishment, his lips moving as if he were trying to frame words but could not. "Louis," he said again, and then I saw he was smiling. A dry, rasping sound came from him as he struggled to his knees and he reached out for me. His blanched, contorted face strained as the sound died in his throat, and he nodded desperately, his red hair loose and disheveled falling into his eyes. I turned and ran from him. Claudia shot past me, gripping me by the arm. "Do you see the color of the sky?" she hissed at me. Morgan fell forward on his hands behind her. "Louis!" he called out again, the light gleaming in his eyes. He seemed blind to the ruins, blind to the night, blind to everything but a face he recognized, that one word again issuing from his lips. I put my hands to my ears, backing away from him. His hand was bloody now as he lifted it. I could smell the blood as well as see it, and Claudia could smell it too. Swiftly she descended on him, pushing him down against the stones, her white fingers moving through his red hair. He tried to raise his head. His outstretched hands made a frame about her face, and then suddenly he began to stroke her yellow curls. She sank her teeth, and the hands dropped helpless at his side. I was at the edge of the forest when she caught up with me. "You must go to him. Take him," she commanded. I could smell the blood on her lips, see the warmth in her cheeks. Her wrist burned against me, yet I did not move. "Listen to me, Louis," she said, her voice at once desperate and angry. "I left him for you, but he's dying. There's no time." I swung her up into my arms and started the long descent. No need for caution, no need for stealth, no preternatural host waiting. The door to the secrets of Eastern Europe was shut against us. I was ploughing through the dark to the road. "Will you listen to me?" she cried out, but I went on in spite of her, her hands clutching at my coat, my hair. "Do you see the sky? Do you see it?" she railed. She was all but sobbing against my breast as I splashed through the icy stream and ran headlong in search of the lantern at the road. The sky was a dark blue when I found the carriage. "Give me the crucifix," I shouted to Claudia as I cracked the whip. "There's only one place to go." She was thrown against me as the carriage rocked into its turn and headed for the village. I had the eeriest feeling then, as I could see the mist rising amongst the dark brown trees. The air was cold and fresh, and the birds had begun. It was as if the sun were rising, yet I did not care. And yet I knew that it was not rising, that there was still time. It was a marvelous, quieting feeling. The scrapes and cuts burned my flesh, and my heart ached with hunger, but my head felt marvelously light. Until I saw the grey shapes of the inn and the steeple of the church, they were too clear, and the stars above were fading fast. In a moment I was hammering on the door of the inn. As it opened, I put my hood up around my face tightly and held Claudia beneath my cape in a bundle. "Your village is rid of the vampire," I said to the woman, who stared at me in astonishment. I was clutching the crucifix which she'd given me. "Thanks be to God, he's dead. You'll find the remains in the tower. Tell this to your people at once," I pushed past her into the inn. The gathering was roused into commotion instantly, but I insisted that I was tired beyond endurance. I must pray and rest. They were to get my chest from the carriage and bring it to a decent room where I might sleep. But a message was to come for me from the bishop at Varna, and for this and this only was I to be awakened. "Tell the good father when he arrives that the vampire is dead, and then give him food and drink and have him wait for me," I said. The woman was crossing herself. "You understand," I said to her as I hurried towards the stairs. "I couldn't reveal my mission to you until after the vampire had been..." "Yes, yes," she said to me, "but you are not a priest. The child..."
"No, only too well versed in these matters. The unholy one is no match for me," I said to her. I stopped. The door of the little parlour stood open with nothing but a white square of cloth on the oak table. "Your friend," she said to me, and she looked at the floor. "He rushed out into the night. He was mad." I only nodded. I could hear them shouting when I shut the door of the room. They seemed to be running in all directions. And then came the sharp sound of the church bell in the rapid peal of alarm. Claudia had slipped down from my arms, and she was staring at me gravely as I bolted the door. Very slowly, I unlatched the shutter of the window. An icy light seeped into the room. Still she watched me. Then I felt her at my side. I looked down to see she was holding out her hand to me. "Here," she said. She must have seen I was confused. I felt so weak that her face was shimmering as I looked at it, the blue of her eyes dancing on her white cheeks. "Drink," she whispered, drawing nearer. "Drink." And she held the soft, tender flesh of the wrist towards me. "No, I know what to do. Haven't I done it in the past?" I said to her. It was she who bolted the window tight, latched the heavy door. I remember kneeling by the small grate and feeling the ancient panelling. It was rotten behind the varnished surface, and it gave under my fingers. Suddenly I saw my fist go through it and felt the sharp jab of splinter in my wrist, and then I remember feeling in the dark and catching hold of something warm and pulsing. A rush of cold, damp air hit my face, and I saw a darkness rising about me, cool and damp, as if this air were a silent water that seeped through the broken wall and filled the room. The room was gone. I was drinking from a never-ending stream of warm blood that flowed down my throat and through my pulsing heart and through my veins, so that my skin warmed against this cool, dark water. And now the pulse of the blood I drank slackened, and all my body cried out for it not to slacken, my heart pounding, trying to make that heart pound with it. I felt myself rising, as if I were floating in the darkness, and then the darkness, like the heartbeat, began to fade. Something glimmered in my swoon. It shivered ever so slightly with the pounding of feet on the stairs, on the floorboards, the rolling of wheels and horses' hooves on the earth, and it gave off a tinkling sound as it shivered. It had a small wooden frame around it, and in that frame there emerged, through the glimmer, the figure of a man. He was familiar. I knew his long, slender build, his black, wavy hair. Then I saw that his green eyes were gazing at me, and in his teeth he was clutching something huge and soft and brown, which he pressed tightly with both his hands. It was a rat, a great, loathsome brown rat he held, its feet poised, its mouth agape, its great curved tail frozen in the air. Crying out, he threw it down and stared aghast, blood flowing from his open mouth. A searing light hit my eyes. I struggled to open them against it, and the entire room was glowing. Claudia was right in front of me. She was not a tiny child, but someone much larger, who drew me forward towards her with both hands. She was on her knees, and my arms encircled her waist. Then darkness descended, and I had her folded against me. The lock slid into place. Numbness came over my limbs, and then the paralysis of oblivion.
And that was how it was throughout Transylvania and Hungary and Bulgaria, and through all those countries where the peasants know that the living dead walk, and the legends of the vampires abound. In every village where we did encounter the vampire, it was the same.
"A mindless corpse?" the boy asked.
"Always," said the vampire. "When we found these creatures at all, I remember a handful at most. Sometimes we only watched them from a distance, all too familiar with their wagging bovine heads, their haggard shoulders, their rotted, ragged clothing. In one hamlet it was a woman, only dead for perhaps a few months. The villagers had glimpsed her and knew her by name. It was she who gave us the only hope we were to experience after the monster in Transylvania, and that hope came to nothing. She fled from us through the forest, and we ran after her, reaching out for her long black hair. Her white burial gown was soaked with dried blood, her fingers caked with the dirt of the grave, and her eyes, they were mindless. Two pools that reflected the moon. No secrets, no truths, only despair."
"But what were these creatures? Why were they like this?" asked the boy, his lips grimacing with disgust.
"I don't understand. How could they be so different from you and Claudia, yet exist?"
"I had my theories. So did Claudia. But the main thing which I had then was despair, and in despair the recurring fear that we had killed the only other vampire like us, Lestat.
Yet it seemed unthinkable. Had he possessed the wisdom of a sorcerer, the powers of a witch, I might have come to understand that he had somehow managed to wrest a conscious life from the same forces that governed these monsters. But he was only Lestat, as I've described him to you, devoid of mystery, finally his limits as familiar to me in those months in Eastern Europe as his charms. I wanted to forget him, and yet it seemed I thought of him always. It was as if the empty nights were made for thinking of him, and sometimes I found myself so vividly aware of him, it was as if he had only just left the room, and the ring of his voice were still there. And somehow there was a disturbing comfort in that, and despite myself, I'd envision his face, not as it had been the last night in the fire, but on other nights, that last evening he spent with us at home, his hand playing idly with the keys of the spinet, his head tilted to one side. A sickness rose in me more wretched than anguish when I saw what my dreams were doing. I wanted him alive. In the dark nights of Eastern Europe, Lestat was the only vampire I'd found.
But Claudia's waking thoughts were of a far more practical nature. Over and over, she had me recount that night in the hotel in New Orleans when she'd become a vampire, and over she searched the process for some clue to why these things we met in the country graveyards had no mind. What if, after Lestat's infusion of blood, she'd been put in a grave, closed up in it until the preternatural drive for blood caused her to break the stone door of the vault that held her? What then would her mind have been, starved as it were to the breaking point? Her body might have saved itself when no mind remained. And through the world she would have blundered, ravaging where she could, as we saw these creatures do. That was how she explained them. But what had fathered them? How had they begun? That was what she couldn't explain, and what gave her hope of discovery when I, from sheer exhaustion, had none. They spawn their own kind, it's obvious, but where does it begin? She asked. And then, somewhere near the outskirts of Vienna, she put the question to me which had never before passed her lips. Why could I not do what Lestat had done with both of us? Why could I not make another vampire? I don't know why at first I didn't even understand her, except that in loathing what I was with every impulse in me, I had a particular fear of that question, which was almost worse than any other. You see, I didn't understand something strong in myself. Loneliness had caused me to think on that very possibility years before, when I had fallen under the spell of Babette Frenière. But I held it locked inside of me like an unclean passion. I shunned mortal life after her. I killed strangers, and the Englishman Morgan, because I knew him, was as safe from my fatal embrace as Babette had been. They both caused me too much pain. Death I couldn't think of giving them. Life in death, it was monstrous. I turned away from Claudia. I wouldn't answer her. But angry as she was, wretched as was her impatience, she could not stand this turning away, and she drew near to me, comforting me with her hands and her eyes as if she were my loving daughter. "Don't think on it, Louis," she said later, when we were comfortably situated in a small suburban hotel. I was standing at the window, looking at the distant glow of Vienna, so eager for that city, its civilization, its sheer size. The night was clear, and the haze of the city was on the sky. "Let me put your conscience at ease, though I'll never know precisely what it is," she said into my ear, her hand stroking my hair. "Do that, Claudia," I answered her. "Put it at ease. Tell me that you'll never speak to me of making vampires again." "I want no orphans such as ourselves," she said, all too quickly. My words annoyed her. My feeling annoyed her. "I want answers." "Knowledge," she said. "But tell me, Louis, what makes you so certain that you've never done this without your knowing it?" Again there was that deliberate obtuseness in me. I must look at her as if I didn't know the meaning of her words. I wanted her to be silent, and to be near me, and for us to be in Vienna. I drew her hair back and let my fingertips touch her long lashes and looked away at the light. "After all, what does it take to make those creatures?" she went on. "Those vagabond monsters? How many drops of your blood intermingled with a man's blood, and what kind of heart to survive that first attack?" I could feel her watching my face, and I stood there, my arms folded, my back to the side of the window, looking out. "That pale-faced Emily, that miserable Englishman," she said, oblivious to the flicker of pain in my face. "Their hearts were nothing. And it was the fear of death as much as the drawing of blood that killed them. The idea killed them. But what of the hearts that survive? Are you sure you haven't fathered a league of monsters who, from time to time, struggled vainly and instinctively to follow in your footsteps? What was their lifespan, these orphans you left behind you? A day there, a week here,
before the sun burnt them to ashes, or some mortal victim cut them down?
Stop it, I begged her.
If you knew how completely I envision everything you describe, you would not describe it. I tell you, it's never happened. Lestat drained me to the point of death to make me a vampire, and gave back all that blood mingled with his own. That is how it was done.
She looked away from me, and it seemed she was looking down at her hands. I think I heard her sigh, but I wasn't certain. And then her eyes moved over me, slowly, up and down, before they finally met mine. Then it seemed she smiled.
"Don't be frightened of my fancy," she said softly. "After all, the final decision will always rest with you. Is that not so?"
"I don't understand," I said, and a cold laughter erupted from her as she turned away.
"Can you picture it?"
she said, so softly I scarcely heard.
"A coven of children? That is all I could provide."
"Claudia," I murmured.
"Rest easy," she said abruptly, her voice still low. "I tell you that as much as I hated Lestat—"
She stopped.
"Yes," I whispered.
"Yes."
"As much as I hated him, with him we were complete."
She looked at me, her eyelids quivering, as if the slight rise in her voice had disturbed her even as it had disturbed me.
"No, only you were complete," I said to her, "because there were two of us, one on either side of you from the beginning."
I thought I saw her smile then, but I was not certain. She bowed her head, but I could see her eyes moving beneath the lashes back and forth, back and forth. And then she said,
"The two of you at my side.
Do you picture that as you say it, as you picture everything else?" One night, long gone by, was as material to me as if I were in it still, but I didn't tell her. She was desperate in that night, running away from Lestat, who had urged her to kill a woman in the street from whom she'd backed off, clearly alarmed. I was sure the woman had resembled her mother. Finally, she'd escaped us entirely, but I'd found her in the armoire, beneath the jackets and coats, clinging to her doll. And, carrying her to her crib, I sat beside her and sang to her. And she stared at me as she clung to that doll, as if trying blindly and mysteriously to calm a pain she herself did not begin to understand.
Can you picture it? This splendid domesticity, dim lamps, the vampire father singing to the vampire daughter. Only the doll had a human face. Only the doll.
"But we must get away from here," said the present Claudia, suddenly, as though the thought had just taken shape in her mind with a special urgency. She had her hand to her ear, as if clutching it against some awful sound.
"From the roads behind us, from what I see in your eyes now because I give voice to thoughts which are nothing more to me than plain considerations."
"Forgive me," I said as gently as I could, withdrawing slowly from that long-ago room, that ruffled crib, that frightened monster child and monster voice. And Lestat.
Where was Lestat?
A match striking in the other room, a shadow leaping suddenly into life, as light and dark come alive where there was only darkness.
"No, you forgive me," she was saying to me now, in this little hotel room near the first capital of Western Europe. "No, we forgive each other, but we don't forgive him. And without him, you see what things are between us."
"Only now because we are tired, and things are dreary," I said to her, and to myself, because there was no one else in the world to whom I could speak.
"Ah, yes. And that is what must end. I tell you, I begin to understand that we have done it all wrong from the start. We must bypass Vienna. We need our language, our people. I want to go directly now to Paris."
Part 3
I think the very name of Paris brought a rush of pleasure to me that was extraordinary. A relief so near to well-being that I was amazed, not only that I could feel it, but that I'd so nearly forgotten it. I wonder if you can understand what it meant. My expression can't convey it now, for what Paris means to me is very different from what it meant then, in those days, at that hour. But still, even now to think of it, I feel something akin to that happiness. And I've more reason now than ever to say that happiness is not what I will ever know, or will ever deserve to know. I am not so much in love with happiness. Yet the name Paris makes me feel it. Mortal beauty often makes me ache, and mortal grandeur can fill me with that longing I felt so hopelessly in the Mediterranean Sea. But Paris drew me close to her heart. So I forgot myself entirely, forgot the damned and questing preternatural thing that doted on mortal skin and mortal clothing. Paris overwhelmed and lightened and rewarded more richly than any promise. It was the mother of New Orleans. Understand that first. It had given New Orleans its life, its first populace, and it was what New Orleans had for so long tried to be. But New Orleans, though beautiful and desperately alive, was desperately fragile. There was something forever savage and primitive there, something that threatened the exotic and sophisticated life both from within and without. Not an inch of those wooden streets, nor a brick of the crowded Spanish houses had not been bought from the fierce wilderness that forever surrounded the city, ready to engulf it. Hurricanes, floods, fevers, the plague, and the damp of the Louisiana climate itself worked tirelessly on every hewn plank or stone facade, so that New Orleans seemed at all times like a dream in the imagination of her striving populace, a dream held intact at every second by a tenacious, though unconscious, collective will. But Paris was a universe, whole and entire unto herself, hollowed and fashioned by history. So she seemed in this age of Napoleon III, with her towering buildings, her massive cathedrals, her grand boulevards, and ancient, winding medieval streets, as vast and indestructible as nature itself. All was embraced by her volatile and enchanted populace thronging the galleries, the theatres, the cafes, giving birth over and over to genius and sanctity, philosophy and war, frivolity and the finest art. So it seemed that if all the world outside her were to sink into darkness, what was fine, what was beautiful, what was essential might there still come to its finest flower. Even the majestic trees that graced and sheltered her streets were attuned to her, and the waters of the Seine, contained and beautiful as they wound through her heart, so that the earth on that spot, so shaped by blood and consciousness, had ceased to be the earth and had become Paris. We were alive again. We were in love. And so euphoric was I after those hopeless nights of wandering in Eastern Europe that I yielded completely when Claudia moved us into the Hotel Saint-Gabriel on the Boulevard des Capucines. It was rumored to be one of the largest hotels in Europe, its immense rooms dwarfing the memory of our old townhouse, while at the same time recalling it with a comfortable splendor. We were to have one of the finest suites. Our windows looked out over the gas-lit boulevard itself, where, in the early evening, the asphalt sidewalks teemed with strollers, and an endless stream of carriages flowed past, taking lavishly dressed ladies and their gentlemen to the opera, or the opera comique, the ballet, the theatres, the balls, and receptions without end at the Tuileries. Claudia put her reasons for expense to me gently and logically, but I could see that she became impatient, ordering everything through me. It was wearing for her. The hotel, she said, quietly afforded us complete freedom, our nocturnal habits going unnoticed in the continual press of European tourists,
our rooms immaculately maintained by an anonymous staff, while the immense price we paid guaranteed our privacy and our security. But there was more to it than that. There was a feverish purpose to her buying.
"This is my world," she explained to me, as she sat in a small velvet chair before the open balcony, watching the long row of brooms stopping one by one before the hotel doors. "I must have it as I like," she said, as if speaking to herself.
And so it was as she liked. Stunning wallpaper of rose and gold, an abundance of damask and velvet furniture, embroidered pillows and silk trappings for the four-poster bed. Dozens of roses appeared daily for the marble mantels and the inlaid tables, crowding the curtained alcove of her dressing room, reflected endlessly in tilted mirrors. And finally she crowded the high French windows with a veritable garden of camellia and fern.
"I miss the flowers. More than anything else I miss the flowers," she mused,
and sought after them even in the paintings which we bought from the shops and the galleries. Magnificent canvases, such as I'd never seen in New Orleans, from the classically executed lifelike bouquets, tempting you to reach for the petals that fell on a three-dimensional tablecloth, to a new and disturbing style in which the colors seemed to blaze with such intensity they destroyed the old lines, the old solidity, to make a vision like to those states when I'm nearest my delirium, and flowers grow before my eyes and crackle like the flames of lamps. Paris flowed into these rooms. I found myself at home there, again forsaking dreams of ethereal simplicity for what another's gentle insistence had given me, because the air was sweet like the air of our courtyard in the Rue Royale, and all was alive with a shocking profusion of gas light that rendered even the ornate, lofty ceilings devoid of shadows. The light raced on the gilt curlicues, flickered in the baubles of the chandeliers. Darkness did not exist. Vampires did not exist. And even bent as I was on my quest, it was sweet to think that, for an hour, father and daughter climbed into the cabriolet from such civilized luxury, only to ride along the banks of the Seine, over the bridge, into the Latin Quarter, to roam those darker, narrower streets in search of history, not victims. And then to return to the ticking clock, and the brass andirons, and the playing cards laid out upon the table. Books of poets, the program from a play, and all around the soft humming of the vast hotel, distant violins, a woman talking in a rapid, animated voice above the zinging of a hairbrush, and a man high above, on the top floor, repeating over and over to the night air, "I understand. I am just beginning. I am just beginning to understand." "Is it as you would have it?" Claudia asked, perhaps just to let me know she hadn't forgotten me, for she was quiet now, for hours. No talk of vampires. But something was wrong. It was not the old serenity, the pensiveness that was recollection. There was a brooding there, a smouldering dissatisfaction. And though it would vanish from her eyes when I would call to her, or answer her, anger seemed to settle very near the surface. "Oh, you know how I would have it," I answered, persisting in the myth of my own will. "Some garret near the Sorbonne, near enough to the noise of the Rue Saint-Michel, far enough away. But I would mainly have it as you would have it." And I could see her, warned, but looking past me, as if to say, "You have no remedy. Don't draw too near. Don't ask of me what I ask of you. Are you content?" My memory is too clear, too sharp. Things should wear at the edges, and what is unresolved should soften. So, scenes are near my heart like pictures in lockets. Yet monstrous pictures no artist or camera would ever catch. And over I would see Claudia at the piano's edge that last night, when Lestat was playing, preparing to die, her face when he was taunting her, that contortion that at once became a mask. Attention might have saved his life, if, in fact, he were dead at all. So
Something was collecting in Claudia, revealing itself slowly to the most unwilling witness in the world. She had a new passion for rings and bracelets children did not wear. Her jaunty, straight-backed walk was not a child's, and often she entered small boutiques ahead of me and pointed a commanding finger at the perfume or the gloves she would then pay for herself. I was never far away, and always uncomfortable, not because I feared anything in this vast city, but because I feared her. She'd always been the lost child to her victims, the orphan, and now it seemed she would be something else, something wicked and shocking to the passers-by who succumbed to her. But this was often private. I was left for an hour haunting the carved edifices of Notre Dame, or sitting at the edge of a park in the carriage. And then one night, when I awoke on the lavish bed in the suite of the hotel, my book crunched uncomfortably under me, I found her gone altogether. I didn't dare ask the attendants if they'd seen her. It was our practice to spirit past them. We had no name. I searched the corridors for her, the side streets, even the ballroom, where some almost inexplicable dread came over me at the thought of her there alone. But then I finally saw her coming through the side doors of the lobby, her hair beneath her bonnet brim sparkling from the light rain, the child rushing as if on a mischievous escapade, lighting the faces of doting men and women as she mounted the grand staircase and passed me, as if she hadn't seen me at all. An impossibility, a strange, graceful slight. I shut the door behind me just as she was taking off her cape. And in a flurry of golden raindrops she shook it, shook her hair. The ribbons crushed from the bonnet fell loose, and I felt a palpable relief to see the childish dress, those ribbons, and something wonderfully comforting in her arms, a small china doll.
Still she said nothing to me. She was fussing with the doll.
Jointed somehow with hooks or wire beneath its flouncing dress, its tiny feet tinkled like a bell. "It's a lady doll," she said, looking up at me. "See, a lady doll." She put it on the dresser. "So it is," I whispered. "A woman made it," she said. "She makes baby dolls. All the same, baby dolls, a shop of baby dolls. Until I said to her, 'I want a lady doll.'" It was taunting, mysterious. She sat there now with the wet strands of hair streaking her high forehead, intent on that doll. "Do you know why she made it for me?" she asked. I was wishing now the room had shadows, that I could retreat from the warm circle of the superfluous fire into some darkness, that I wasn't sitting on the bed as if on a lighted stage, seeing her before me and in her mirrors, puffed sleeves and puffed sleeves. "Because you are a beautiful child, and she wanted to make you happy," I said, my voice small and foreign to myself. She was laughing soundlessly.
"A beautiful child," she said, glancing up at me. "Is that what you still think I am?"
And her face went dark as again she played with the doll, her fingers pushing the tiny crocheted neckline down toward the china breasts.
"Yes, I resemble her baby dolls. I am her baby dolls. You should see her working in that shop, bent on her dolls, each with the same face, lips."
Her finger touched her own lip. Something seemed to shift suddenly, something within the very walls of the room itself, and the mirrors trembled with her image as if the earth had sighed beneath the foundations. Carriages rumbled in the streets, but they were too far away, and then I saw what her still childish figure was doing. In one hand she held the doll, the other to her lips, and the hand that held the doll was crushing it and popping it so it bobbed and broke in a heap of glass that fell now from her open bloody hand onto the carpet. She wrung the tiny dress to make a shower of littering particles as I averted my eyes, only to see her in the tilted mirror over the fire, see her eyes scanning me from my feet to the top of my head. She moved through that mirror towards me and drew close on the bed.
"Why do you look away? Why don't you look at me?" she asked, her voice very smooth, very like a silver bell. But then she laughed softly, a woman's laugh, and said, "Did you think I'd be your daughter forever? Are you the father of fools, the fool of fathers?" "Your tone is unkind with me," I answered. "Unkind," I think she nodded. She was ablaze in the corner of my eye, blue flames, golden flames. "And what do they think of you?" I asked as gently as I could. "Out there?" I gestured to the open window. "Many things," she smiled. "Many things. Men are marvelous at explanations. Have you seen the little people in the parks, the circuses, the freaks that men pay money to laugh at?" "I was a sorcerer's apprentice only," I burst out suddenly, despite myself. "Apprentice," I said. I wanted to touch her, to stroke her hair, but I sat there, afraid of her, her anger like a match about to kindle. Again she smiled, and then she drew my hand into her lap and covered it as best she could with her own. "Apprentice, yes," she laughed. "But tell me one thing from that lofty height. What was it like making love?" I was walking away from her before I meant to. I was searching like a dim-witted mortal man for cape and gloves. "You don't remember?" she asked with perfect calm, as I put my hand on the brass door handle. I stopped, feeling her eyes on my back, ashamed, and then I turned around and made as if to think, "Where am I going? What shall I do? Why do I stand here?" "It was something hurried," I said, trying now to meet her eyes. How perfectly, coldly blue they were. How earnest. "And it was seldom savored. Something acute that was quickly lost. I think that it was the pale shadow of killing." "Ah," she said, "like hurting you as I do now. That is also the pale shadow of killing."
"Yes, madame," I said to her.
"I am inclined to believe that is correct," and bowing swiftly I bade her good night. It was a long time after I'd left her that I slowed my pace. I'd crossed the Seine. I wanted darkness, to hide from her, and the feelings that welled up in me, and the great consuming fear that I was utterly inadequate to make her happy, or to make myself happy by pleasing her. I would have given the world to please her, the world we now possessed, which seemed at once empty and eternal. Yet I was injured by her words and by her eyes, and no amount of explanations to her, which passed through and through my mind now, even forming on my lips in desperate whispers as I left the Rue Saint-Michel and went deeper and deeper into the older, darker streets of the Latin Quarter. No amount of explanations seemed to soothe what I imagined to be her grave dissatisfaction, or my own pain. Finally, I left off words except for a strange chant. I was in the black silence of a medieval street, and blindly I followed its sharp turns, comforted by the height of its narrow tenements, which seemed at any moment capable of falling together, closing this alleyway under the indifferent stars like a seam. I cannot make her happy. I do not make her happy, and her unhappiness increases every day. This was my chant, which I repeated like a rosary, a charm to change the facts, her inevitable disillusionment with our quest, which left us in this limbo where I felt her drawing away from me, dwarfing me with her enormous need. I even conceived a savage jealousy of the dollmaker to whom she'd confided her request for that tinkling, diminutive lady, because that dollmaker had for a moment given her something which she held close to herself in my presence, as if I were not there at all. What did it amount to? Where could it lead? Never since I'd come to Paris months before did I so completely feel the city's immense size. How I might pass from this twisting, blind street of my choice into a world of delights, and never had I so keenly felt its uselessness.
Uselessness to her if she could not abide this anger, if she could not somehow grasp the limits of which she seemed so angrily, bitterly aware.
I was helpless. She was helpless. But she was stronger than I, and I knew, had known even at the moment when I turned away from her in the hotel, that behind her eyes there was for me her continuing love. And dizzy and weary and now comfortably lost, I became aware, with a vampire's inextinguishable senses, that I was being followed. My first thought was irrational. She'd come out after me, and, cleverer than I, had tracked me at a great distance. But as surely as this came to mind, another thought presented itself, a rather cruel thought in light of all that had passed between us. The steps were too heavy for hers. It was just some mortal walking in this same alley, walking unwarily towards death. So I continued on, almost ready to fall into my pain again because I deserved it, when my mind said, "You are a fool. Listen." And it dawned on me that these steps, echoing as they were at a great distance behind me, were in perfect time with my own. An accident. Because if mortal they were too far off for mortal hearing. But as I stopped now to consider that, they stopped. And as I turned, saying, "Louis, you deceive yourself," and started up, they started up. Footfall with my footfall, gaining speed now as I gained speed. And then something remarkable, undeniable occurred. On guard as I was for the steps that were behind me, I tripped on a fallen roof tile and was pitched against the wall, and behind me those steps echoed to perfection the sharp, shuffling rhythm of my fall. I was astonished, and in a state of alarm well beyond fear. To the right and left of me the street was dark. Not even a tarnished light shone in a garret window. And the only safety afforded me, the great distance between myself and those steps, was, as I said, the guarantee that they were not human. I was at a complete loss as to what I might do. I had the near, irresistible desire to call out to this being and welcome it, to let it know as quickly and as completely as possible that I awaited it, had been searching for it, would confront it. Yet I was afraid. What seemed sensible was to resume walking, waiting for it to gain on me, and as I did so I was again mocked by my own pace, and a distance between us remained the same. The tension mounted in me, the dark around me becoming more and more menacing, and I said over and over, measuring these steps, "Why do you track me? Why do you let me know you are there?" Then I rounded a sharp turn in the street, and a gleam of light showed ahead of me at the next corner. The street sloped up towards it, and I moved on very slowly, my heart deafening in my ears, reluctant to eventually reveal myself in that light. And as I hesitated, stopped, in fact, right before the turn something rumbled and clattered above, as if the roof of the house beside me had all but collapsed. I jumped back just in time before a load of tiles crashed into the street, one of them brushing my shoulder. All was quiet now. I stared at the tiles, listening, waiting.
And then slowly I edged around the turn into the light, only to see there looming over me at the top of the street beneath a gas lamp the unmistakable figure of another vampire.
He was enormous in height, though gaunt as myself, his long white face very bright under the lamp, his large black eyes staring at me in what seemed undisguised wonder. His right leg was slightly bent as though he'd just come to a halt in mid-step. And then, suddenly, I realized that not only was his black hair long and full and combed precisely like my own, and not only was he dressed in identical coat and cape to my own, but he stood imitating my stance and facial expression to perfection. I swallowed, and let my eyes pass over him slowly,
while I struggled to hide from him the rapid pace of my pulse as his eyes in like manner passed over me. And when I saw him blink, I realized I had just blinked. And as I drew my arms up and folded them across my chest, he slowly did the same. It was maddening, worse than maddening,
because as I barely moved my lips, he barely moved his lips, and I found the words dead, and I couldn't make other words to confront this, to stop it.
And all the while, there was that height, and those sharp, black eyes, and that powerful attention which was, of course, perfect mockery, but nevertheless riveted to myself. He was the vampire. I seemed the mirror. "Clever," I said to him shortly and desperately, and, of course, he echoed that word as fast as I said it. And maddened as I was more by that than anything else, I found myself yielding to a slow smile, defying the sweat which had broken from every pore and the violent tremor in my legs. He also smiled, but his eyes had a ferocity that was animal, unlike my own, and his smile was sinister in its sheer mechanical quality. Now I took a step forward, and so did he, and when I stopped short staring, so did he. But then he slowly, very slowly, lifted his right arm, though mine remained poised, and gathering his fingers into a fist, he now struck at his chest in quickening time to mock my heartbeat. Laughter erupted from him. He threw back his head, showing his canine teeth, and the laughter seemed to fill the alleyway. I loathed him completely. "You mean me harm?" I asked, only to hear the words mockingly obliterated. "Trickster," I said sharply. "Buffoon." That word stopped him, died on his lips even as he was saying it, and his face went hard. What I did then was impulse. I turned my back on him and started away, perhaps to make him come after me and demand to know who I was. But in a movement so swift I couldn't possibly have seen it, he stood before me again, as if he had materialized there. Again I turned my back on him, only to face him under the lamp again, the settling of his dark, wavy hair the only indication that he had, in fact, moved. "I've been looking for you. I've come to Paris looking for you." I forced myself to say the words, seeing that he didn't echo them or move, only stood staring at me. Now he moved forward, slowly, gracefully, and I saw his own body and his own manner had regained possession of him, and extending his hand as if he meant to ask for mine, he very suddenly pushed me backwards, off balance. I could feel my shirt drenched and sticking to my flesh as I righted myself, my hand grimed from the damp wall. And as I turned to confront him, he threw me completely down. I wish I could describe to you his power. You would know, if I were to attack you, to deal you a sharp blow with an arm you never saw move towards you. But something in me said, "Show him your own power." And I rose up fast, going right for him with both arms out, and I hit the night, the empty night swirling beneath that lamppost, and stood there looking about me, alone and a complete fool. This was a test of some sort. I knew it then, though consciously I fixed my attention on the dark street, the recesses of the doorways, any place he might have hidden. I wanted no part of this test, but saw no way out of it. And I was contemplating some way to disdainfully make that clear when suddenly he appeared again, jerking me around and flinging me down the sloping cobblestones where I'd fallen before. I felt his boot against my ribs, and enraged I grabbed hold of his leg, scarcely believing it when I felt the cloth and the bone. He'd fallen against the stone wall opposite and let out a snarl of unrepressed anger. What happened then was pure confusion. I held tight to that leg, though the boot strained to get at me, and at some point after he toppled over me and pulled loose from me, I was lifted into the air by strong hands. What might have happened, I can well imagine. He could have flung me several yards from himself, he was easily that strong, and battered,
Severely injured, I might have lost consciousness.
It was violently disturbing to me, even in that melee, that I didn't know whether I could lose consciousness.
But it was never put to a test, for confused as I was certain someone else had come between us. Someone who was battling him decisively, forcing him to relinquish his hold. When I looked up, I was in the street and I saw two figures.